You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
Thanks for joining us. Robert Blair Kaiser is one of those men who've been around great events and great people for much of his journalistic life. He's our guest in this hour, reminiscing about a life in journalism, covering the Kennedys, covering Vatican II, what it's taught him about life and the way we ought to live it. Robert Blair Kaiser along in just a few moments' time. Following Robert Blair Kaiser, we're going to take the opportunity to have the Midnight Inquisition, some favourite tunes, and then the third in a repeat series of meditations that we've been following through over the last few weeks from Dom Lawrence Freeman, well-known practitioner of the art of meditation and teacher of many thousands around the world in seminars. He conducts the John Main seminars. He'll be our guest in the third of his meditation series that we're conducting in conjunction with World Youth Day, which is coming up in the next couple of weeks. Robert Blair Kaiser, of course, is in Australia for World Youth Day in the lead-up. He's published a new book called Cardinal Mahony, which is his adventure into fiction, a novel about a cardinal, conservative cardinal, who sees the light and becomes a reforming champion of a new United States form of Catholicism. Robert Blair Kaiser chose for his introductory piece of music something quite portentous. Herbert von Karajan, the Berlin Philharmonic, and yes, you guessed it, Also Sprach Zarathustra. Also Sprach Zarathustra, the music of Richard Strauss. It's a selection of our guest, Robert Blair Kaiser. Who, you ask? Robert Blair Kaiser, for those of us who are interested in religion and journalism, is perhaps one of those figures we like to conjure with. He's been writing about religion, politics, and the big trends in the world for over 40 years. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for joining us. You've been mixing around this turf since Vatican II. As a young journalist, what drew you into religion as a specialty?
I'd been a Jesuit for 10 years, and I came out 3 years shy of ordination, got a job with a local newspaper in Phoenix, Arizona. After 3 years there, I went out to the home of Claire Booth Luce. She had a winter home in Phoenix with her husband.
This is the founders of Time magazine.
Right. She sat in on the interview, and when it was over, she said, "I've been reading your stuff in the newspaper and wondering who you were and what you wanted to do with your life." And I said, "I think I'd like to work for Time." And she said, "I think I can be of some assistance." So 6 months later, I was covering the Vatican for Time magazine in Rome. I was blessed, you know. It was just
That's
great.
Not a bad kickstart.
Right. Yeah.
Now, you happened to arrive in Rome at a particular time as well. You arrived at a time when the church was realizing that the church had to respond to the world in a profoundly different way.
John the 23rd, the Pope at the time, the best Pope we've ever had, had that sense of history. He was an historian anyway, not a theologian or a canon lawyer. And he knew that there was a new world coming and that the church had to get ready for it. And he brought in 2,500 bishops from around the world. They absolutely negated the power of the Roman Curia, the bureaucrats who've been running things for the last 100 years in Rome, negated their power, and they wrote a charter for a church of the people, as opposed to, say, a church of the clergy. Unfortunately, that charter was repealed by John Paul II during his 25 years in the papacy, and Benedict XVI is not much better, and so we're still struggling. We Vatican II types who want a people's church are still struggling to try to help create one.
John the 23rd, the aura around him is still significant. He's seen as the last great saintly pope by many.
Right.
In some ways, too, as an accidental pope. Somebody who just sort of tripped into the office, and he's painted as this peasant who actually made a few good decisions along the way.
The people who nominated him and voted for him to be pope thought he wouldn't be any trouble at all, but he had a secret agenda. He wanted to change the church rather radically, and he had some advisors, some great theologians who were helping him.
What was the genius of the man? He seems to have been able to look at the world in a rather large way and at the same time attract to him people who were big thinkers, yet at the same time keep his feet on the ground. This is a difficult trick.
He was probably a good newspaper reader. He had a wet finger to the breeze. He read what he called the signs of the times, which he interpreted as voice of the Holy Spirit itself, who was working through men
and
women.
So he looked outwards rather than inwards.
Oh, yeah.
Did his career prepare him for that?
Yes. He was a diplomat in Bulgaria during the World War II, and then was sent to Paris, and he was the chief papal diplomat, the nuncio in Paris after the war, and he rubbed elbows with all the great French and Belgian and Dutch theologians who would flock into Paris and have private meetings with him.
Because at that time in Paris, of course, is the worker priest movement and other things.
Great ferment.
Yes.
See, the World War II shook these thinking theologians, shook them up real good. They said, we have not been very relevant to the history of the world here. We've kind of let two world wars happen before our eyes. The church became too much of a thing to itself and not involved enough into the hurly-burly of the action and passion of their times, and they wanted to change that.
Vatican II also came at a time of a great shift, almost a paradigm shift, culturally in the West as well. Yeah. How much is it a cause and a product of that moment?
There
that
was
early 60s moment.
It was like alternating current. There's a reciprocity between what the church was doing and what society was doing. There was John the 23rd, I like to say, tried to make the church more democratic, more pluralistic, more free, more human, more humble in the face of history. He was presenting a church that didn't know everything. The previous popes pretended like they knew everything about everything. He was a kind of a skeptic.
But he walks into a church and he begins to change it just at the moment when the world itself, when a new generation born in the 50s gets to university in the 60s,
right,
begins to say, we need to change things
right
as well.
Right.
So how much is he a product of or a cause of, or a partial cause of, what then happens in the 60s? Because the church, the foundations of the church begin to shake, and then it seems you have Paris in 1968.
If I had to make a choice, John, I would say he was more of a cause than an effect. And he was a cause in this sense. We wanted to grow up, but we needed Daddy's permission to grow up. And he said it was okay to grow up, and then we started to grow up.
Because this has great effect in the United States. At the same time, you have the emergence of the first Catholic president, the Kennedys, and on the cusp of that very same ethos.
Right, exactly. Interesting.
We're talking about a cultural moment.
Yeah,
that seems
we had
to be
two Johns simultaneously, John Kennedy and John the 23rd.
And, of course, you've written about this yourself. You've
right
particularly written about Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
I'd like to come to that in a moment.
Okay.
So first, though, let's have another piece of music. Our guest on Sunday night, Robert Blair Kaiser. We're talking about religion, culture, and the past half century. You may have some opinions. You can share them with us in our chat room a little later on. But for now, Robert Blair Kaiser, another piece of music. I'm going to be a bit cheeky here. You've chosen a little extract from My Fair Lady. Why can't a woman learn to speak? Now, all of us carry around images of Rex Harrison in this role. Why have you chosen this?
It's because I believe the exact opposite of Rex Harrison. I think that if we paid attention to women, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in the church or in society. If women had more control over the polity of the United States, over our politics, we wouldn't be up to our neck in trouble in Iraq, for example. George Bush has gotten away with murder. And he had.
And you think Hillary would have done a better job than Barack?
No, I don't think so. No, it's beyond that now. I think Hillary and Barack are on the same page. It's been a tough primary season. I like both of them, but we sort of had to make our choice between somebody that we didn't know enough about to mistrust and somebody that we knew too much about and we did mistrust her.
Why can't a woman learn to speak?
Women are irrational, that's all there is to that. Their heads are full of cotton, hay, and rags. They're nothing but exasperating, irritating, vacillating, calculating, agitating, maddening, and infuriating hags. Pickering, why can't a woman be more like a man?
I beg your pardon?
Yes, why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair. Who, when you win, will always give your back a pat. But why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why don't they grow up, well, like their father instead? Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. Whenever you're with them, you're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
Would you be livid if I had a drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you? One man in a million may shout a bit. Now and then there's one with slight defects. One perhaps whose truthfulness you doubt a bit. But by and large, we are a marvelous sex. Why can't a woman take after a man? Because men are so friendly, good-natured and kind. A better companion you never will find. If I were hours late for dinner, would you bellow?
Of course.
If I forgot your silly birthday, would you fuss?
Nonsense.
Would you complain if I took out another fellow?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like us? Mrs. Pierce, you're a woman. Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so decent, such regular chaps, ready to help you through any mishaps, ready to buck you up whenever you are glum. Why can't a woman be a chum? Why is thinking something women never do? But why is logic never even tried? Straightening up their hair is all they ever do. Why don't they straighten up the mess that's inside? Why can't a woman behave like a man? If I was a woman who'd been to a ball, been hailed as a princess by one and by all, would I start weeping like a bathtub overflowing? Or carry on as if my home were in a tree? Would I run off and never tell me where I'm going? Why can't a woman be like me?
My Fair Lady. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest Robert Blair Kaiser, journalist on both politics, religion and culture over the past 40 years, and we're tracing through some of the interesting events over that life in journalism. Robert, I mentioned just before we had a delightful piece of music, the Kennedys, particularly Robert Kennedy. Now, he is again painted as either a pure white knight or a dark, bleak manipulator behind the scenes. You wrote about the man, and we've seen the movie Bobby in the last 12 months.
Right. A new Robert Kennedy began to emerge after the assassination of his brother John. He became much more serious. He became much more reflective about where the country was going. Above all, he became very much anti-war in Vietnam. And I think he was assassinated because he was so much against the war party, the people who were profiteering over that Vietnam War. There's another author that I recommend to your readers. I don't know if he's in Australia yet or not. His name is James Douglas, with two S's at the end. James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable. And it's all about the assassination of John Kennedy. And his thesis is that the CIA, acting at the behest of the war party in the United States, had John Kennedy assassinated. He quotes, for example, Robert Kennedy, who was the first conspiracy theorist. Robert Kennedy called John McCone, the head of the CIA, the day that he found out that Jack was assassinated, November 22nd, 1963, and said, "John, did your guys at the CIA have anything to do with this?" Now, John McCone was just a recently appointed director. He didn't know. I think there was probably a rogue group within the CIA who may well have done Jack Kennedy in. And I think that if Robert Kennedy had been elected president, which he would have been had he not been popped off by this young Arab assassin, he would have tried to get to the bottom of that.
You think Sirhan Sirhan was part of that conspiracy, or just a rogue element himself?
He was an unwitting tool of it. I believe he was programmed under hypnosis to kill Robert Kennedy and programmed to forget that he was programmed. And I have a new version of my book just out, came out 2 weeks ago on the 40th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's assassination, called RFK Must Die, Chasing the Mystery.
There's another Oliver Stone movie here.
Yeah, could well be. I like Oliver Stone. I love his movies, but he had some bad history there. Intriguing movie, but I don't think he was on the right track.
One likes to assume that documentary evidence lies buried somewhere, which could either ultimately prove or disprove these conspiracy hypotheses. Do you think anything will ever surface?
Well, gosh, you know, the propensity of bureaucracy to cover up their sins is pretty great. And if push comes to shove, they'll even burn the documents if they have to. Maybe there's still some documents extant, but we have some, there are some pretty good, solid conspiracy theorists out there who are trying to get to the records of the CIA and find out where certain key agents were on the night of June the 4th, 1968, when Bob Kennedy was assassinated. We think they were at the Ambassador Hotel.
I'd love to pursue that with you, but I think we'll leave that for a tantalizing moment and urge people to read your new book on Robert F. Kennedy. You're also the author of another book, Cardinal Mahony, in which you paint a picture of a revived and renewed Catholic Church coming out of the ruins of the sexual abuse scandal. And I'd like to trace the path of that book in a moment, because it's very much linked to the political models we've been talking about. You pose as the starting point of your book a moment in which a seeming terrorist group kidnaps a cardinal. It turns out the terrorists are liberation theologians who wish the cardinal to take a new course in life, and under the influence of the Stockholm Syndrome, he does.
Right. Falls in love with his kidnappers. Right.
And we have Camelot for the church.
Right.
We'll get into that in a moment. But again, you're using the elements of the political currents of the last 30 years to paint the picture of your book. Let's stick with those political currents for a moment. The Kennedy era, the 60s, end in the tragedies of Vietnam and Watergate. In some ways, there's a parallel journey for the church as well. The promise of Vatican II is never realized. Congregations in the West keep collapsing. The conservatives say, see, it didn't work.
Right.
There is, again, a parallel between religion and politics here in the last 30 years. It's pretty direct.
You're a very astute observer here. You're right on the money. Both in the civil arena and in the ecclesiastical arena, there's a movement toward more power to the people. And we get some of it, and then it's suddenly snatched away from us by assassination or whatever. And that's the mystery.
If we follow the conspiracy line a little, it's the tendency of power to reassert itself. It gets distributed out a little bit, and then it pulls back into the elites.
And they're guilty of the seven deadly sins. greed among them, one of the chief among them. Often it comes down to the almighty dollar. Cui bono is the old saying.
Who benefits?
Who benefits from this? And if you ask that question, you find out that in the current American scene, for example, George Bush and his administration have hijacked America on behalf of their friends in corporate America.
See, another argument put by many of the conservatives would be to say, no, we've simply rescued society from the liberal elites who were about destroying it.
Well, they can say that, but I like to think that we have two parties, the Change Party and the No Change Party. And the No Change Party are very damn comfortable with their lot. The Party of Change wants their living body, their living church, to change, because if it doesn't, it'll be a museum piece and it won't have any relevance at all. And the same is true of the United States as a country, and same is true of Australia. You've got to change to keep up with the times. My God, the times are changing so fast we can hardly keep up with them, just in the area of communications alone. Information is the most subversive thing in the world, and boy, we're in the middle of the information revolution. If we don't change, we're doomed.
The question is in what direction change should go. There are those who say, look, ultimately, many of these things can't be sorted out by intellectual intervention, because that begins ultimately to turn into big government. What we've got to allow is the democracy of the market.
There you
to
go.
Reign.
Well, now, interesting you should use that phrase. Have you read James Serovecki, The Wisdom of Crowds? Marvelous, thin little book in which he says, the people at large are always right. The experts are always wrong.
The census fidelium.
Yeah, that's a modern translation of the old Catholic term, sense of the faithful. There's a sense of the rightness, and you don't expect an expert to know enough to put his blessing on it until he hears the voice of the people. Vox populi, vox Dei.
But there is also a sense of which certain historic moments are reached in culture. You had that moment both in the church and society in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Are we now approaching such a time again? You have economic stresses around the world. You have the beginning of a liberal ascendancy, it appears, in the United States, where people are saying, yes, we are more willing to look at the big picture. It's not just about me and my local self. It's about the globe.
Yeah.
Do you sense that another moment such as that is re-emerging?
Absolutely. The watchword in the Obama campaign was change, and we voted for him. He's going to be the candidate for the Democratic Party. We're giving him a mandate for change, if we elect him. I'm afraid we may not. I'm afraid there are a lot of secret racists in the United States who say they are not racist, but when they get into the privacy of the polling booth, they'll pull the lever for John McCain instead. So we'll see. Nothing is certain here, but I think you're right. There's something in the air that says, gosh, we've gone too far in this other direction. Let's pull back to our roots. Let's have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And what I'm saying in my book, Cardinal Mahoney, is we need that same thing in the church, a people's church. We need to give the people of the church a voice and a vote and ownership of what they keep telling us is our church. What a farce that is, because I'm a member of a certain number of liberal Catholic groups in the United States, and we can't meet on church property because the bishops fear us on meeting on their church. Well, we paid for it. My folks paid for it. My grandfolks paid for it, but we can't even use it.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you, our guest Robert Blair Kaiser. Let's have another piece of music. And this one puzzles me. You have chosen a little Julie Andrews. The hills are alive with the sound of music. Now, this does take us back to a period immediately before the 1960s. This is the 1950s when the world in all its stability and loveliness had emerged out of the ashes of the Second World War. And Julie Andrews was singing of a chocolate box world.
I'm kind of a Pollyanna. I have high hopes. People say, Kaiser, you're whistling Dixie. This isn't going to happen. And I say, well, you never can tell. I'm hopeful. I think that's one of the three theological virtues, if I'm not mistaken, faith, hope, and charity. Faith, hope, and love, and I'm hopeful.
The hills are alive.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze, to laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones on its way, to sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray. I go
The hills are alive with the sound of music. And the song this evening is being sung by Robert Blair-Kaiser, our guest on Sunday night. Robert Blair-Kaiser, let's talk about the church. We've spoken about religion, politics, and the intersection of society. Your book, Cardinal Mahony, actually starts with is centred on the sexual abuse crisis of the church.
Right.
That's the lever upon which it hinges. And you use that lever effectively to build a picture of both the worst and the best of the church. What is the worst of the church at the moment?
Well, the worst of it is that the Pope and the bishops act like Lord bishops and not servant bishops. We need to take the church back to its most primitive days when there wasn't even a hierarchy, when liturgies were celebrated very informally in households in the Middle East mainly, often enough presided over by women, no hierarchy, Christians living together and helping each other.
You're talking about a church in the first and second centuries.
Right, exactly, yeah. And we've gotten away from that. The church is a human thing. It's governed. I'm not talking about the faith now, that we pretty much believe
what
we believe.
You're talking about the church as an institution.
Right, and the way we govern ourselves. And it wasn't always governed as an absolute monarchy acting absolutely, as it is today. The Pope may be the only absolute monarch left in the world today. In the first 6 centuries of the church, the people of Rome elected their Pope.
A number of people have chosen to say that the real failure of the church was the Constantinian Revolution, where the Roman Empire and the church in some ways became fused and the model presided. Yet one could almost be caused to go to the Monty Python phrase there, what have the Romans ever done for us? I mean, there is some benefit in that fusion of the Church of the West with Rome, in that what it provided was a way for a set of universals to begin to apply.
There was a stability. They created a kind of stability.
But it was an ethical universals as well, too, wasn't it?
Right.
It no longer became the local tribe that determined.
Right.
Now, there's great benefit in that. I mean, it provided the platform for a civilization to emerge over the next 2,000 years.
Yeah.
Or 1600
years. And, you know, there's a great benefit to having all the world's oil in the hands of a few people.
What I'm suggesting here is it's neither one nor the other, is it?
No. Well, we need a balance.
I'll give you another example, the American Civil War. here is Abraham Lincoln fighting for a set of universals. Didn't express them as anti-slavery. He's fighting for a sort of almost an enlightenment view of the world. And yet he approaches the best general he knows, Robert E. Lee, to support him. And Lee says, I've got to fight for my country. And he defines his country as Virginia, the local.
Right.
And this tension between the universal and the local is a continuing tension in any discussion about how we best order ourselves.
That's very true.
And that's a tension that applies in the church, does it not?
It helps make for better newspapers and better stories, because we've always got a battle going on.
It applies in your book as well. You use a word called autochthony, which is a word to describe the way the church is able to govern itself according to the local sensibility, the local culture.
And still be in communion with Rome. Right.
And what I'm suggesting is that is not an ideal type, because in its own self, that autochthonous model can lead you into all sorts of local primitivisms, if you like.
At this point in history, we need more autochthony. Maybe 100 years after autochthony is in vogue, we're going to have to move back. The pendulum will have to swing back the other way. But right now, the problem is that we have an absolute pope ruling absolutely, and Lord Acton pointed out quite well, that's corrupt. There's no checks and balances. I see an American church, it'll be different in different lands, but an American church modeled after the U.S. Constitution, where we have tripartite government, legislative, judicial, and executive branch that check and balance each other, and covered by the press, because the people want to know what's going on. And right now in the Catholic Church, everything is secret. It has been for centuries.
Can you have an autochthonous church anymore? That is it possible? For example, currently the Anglican Church is riven internationally by the tension between the conservatives and the liberals, to use the pejorative terminology that's slung around. The conservatives are the ones, in this case, who have chosen to go a sort of autochthonous model.
Right.
They are saying, no, we need the right to decide for ourselves. Canterbury is no longer going to be our confessional head. We are going to have our own confessing congregations. But it's not geographic. They are actually saying their autochthonous model is not geographic. It's going to have
flying. It's in Australia, it's in Africa, and so
we will
forth.
Cede allegiance to whomever we like.
That's now, right. But there's something to be said.
In some extent,
there's something to be said for local control. That's where the real church happens. The high falderal of the Vatican and the pageantry in St. Peter's Square isn't the real church. The real church is where people get on their knees and pray to Jesus, and our fathers and mothers of families. That's where the real church is.
Here's an emergent Calvinist.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, there was something good about the Protestant revolt. They were correcting some terrible abuses in the Roman Catholic Church.
The correction of abuses is, again, central to your discussion in Mahony, the novel. Mm-hmm. You paint a picture of a church which you've given us some instance of, sexual abuse crisis in the church. How damaging has that been?
In the short term, very, because it's forced a lot of Catholics to say, what nonsense, we don't want to have anything to do with priests anymore. If they encounter a priest coming toward them on the street, they'll cross over so they don't have to talk to him. A lot of priests are going out in mufti. They don't even wear their Roman collars anymore. So in the short term, that's not so good. And yet, in the long term, why do we need priests at all? I'm talking about some new theology, new sacramental theology, about the priesthood of the faithful, the kind of priesthood we had before there were priests.
I'll talk about that in a moment. On the sexual abuse thing, the reason I want to concentrate on that for a moment is because there's an Australian bishop, a retired Australian bishop, who is, in a way, using that abuse crisis to lay out politically the same things that you're doing in a novel. And Geoffrey Robinson has taken a very courageous stand as a bishop. And again, he's come under some criticism from the Vatican, yes. Particularly because of his recent visit to the United States.
I traveled with him on that visit. So he's a friend of mine. I had 3 breakfasts with him. I was a house guest in the same house he was in Philadelphia. So he's a friend of mine, and we are on the same page. Yeah. But what triggered him, he said publicly here in Sydney that he faulted John Paul II for not doing enough about the scandal. And because of that, word got back to Rome, and Cardinal Ray, one of the high mucky-mucks in Rome, put out the word that he was close to heresy. For criticizing a pope? Come on. That isn't real, not in the 21st century. That comes out of a sense of arrogance, of authority, of, boy, we know everything, and this poor little old bishop in Australia, what does he know, and how dare he criticize the Pope? And yet he was right on the money. And one of the major points that he brought out was celibacy is much more important in this whole equation than we ever thought. Celibacy, he said, is interpreted to mean sexlessness, and sexlessness is holiness, wrongly equated with holiness. But once they've got this holiness thing going for them, they can do almost anything they want, and we have to stand back. We, the people, have to stand back and say, oh, yes, sorry, Your Honor, you must be speaking for God. I'm sorry. And, of course, that's the abuse right there. The bishops who covered up for their miscreant priests are more at fault than anybody, and that was done with the approval of Rome. That's the worst part.
Realistically, do you think that in the next 5 to 10 years, there is any chance that this vision you have is even remotely realizable? Are there aggregations of power within the church, within the United States, who are capable of exercising more independence? I mean, the bishops have always had the capacity in terms of church law to seize the day, but they never do.
Theoretically, yes, but they're always looking over their shoulder at Rome and putting their wet finger to the breeze, and the breeze always blows from Rome. But there's another breeze possible, and it's the voice of public opinion. And we need to get a mass of critical public opinion going, and it's a lot easier today with the media being what it is and the internet also. We might be able to achieve a critical mass. Now, I don't know how big a critical mass of public opinion we need. It may be only 5%.
But the bulk of those going to church to mass these days are people who have come from traditional cultures, Latino cultures in the United States, the immigrant cultures in Australia. They do not represent the progressive end of the church generally.
The younger Hispanics in America do. Their parents are the ones who are more conservative. The rosary praying Catholics. The younger Hispanics are looking for something new. They still want to be Catholic, but they want to be Catholic in a new way. They want to be American Catholics.
And that's dangerously Protestant.
Nothing wrong with that. See, the Protestants had a vision, and when they started in this in the United States, they adopted the modes of the U.S. Constitution. They became more of a people's church. When the Romans came over, the Roman Catholics, they were still looking to the Pope, with some exceptions. We had a marvelous bishop, John England. He was sent to Charleston, South Carolina in 1820, and he quickly got into the democracy, and he wrote a constitution for his church.
It's why Rome, though, does have a consistent problem with the American culture, isn't it? Because the culture is Protestant.
Yes.
Quite irrespective of the church, that people live in a culture which is shaped by Protestant theological foundations.
Yes.
And
Nothing wrong with that.
No. But I'm saying this creates a tension that is continuing between Rome and America, which identifies as a sort of liberal.
I don't know if your audience knows this, but in 1898, Pope Leo XIII condemned a heresy called Americanism. He was afraid of the democracy in the civil arena in the United States seeping into the church itself. We're all, my friends and I, would like to see the election of bishops in every diocese, because they would then be accountable to us and not to the Pope. If George Bush appointed all the mayors in America, would they be accountable to the people of Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles, or would they be accountable to George Bush? The answer is obvious.
Robert Blair Kaiser, we're in the midst of one of the largest demonstrations of Catholic unity worldwide. World Youth Day. The Pope comes to Sydney. A train accompanies him of all sorts of things, ranging from people such as yourself who just happen to be in town, but also the sort of dead bodies of sainted folk. So there's a mixture of modernism and medievalism here that's somewhat puzzling to people who stand outside the Catholic tradition.
Coming where I'm coming from, I just think it's a circus. It's a piece of triumphalism designed to show the rest of the world that the Catholic Church is still powerful enough to draw a crowd bigger than the Olympic Games drew in the year 2000 here in Sydney. But I also think, along with James Joyce, Catholicism, he said once, was here comes everybody. There ought to be room in the church for everybody. And there's a lot more that unites us than what divides us. And I can take the silly pomposity of a papal procession, and I can accept it as, well, that's part, you know, you have to have a sense of humor about this thing. We do have a history, and this is a throwback to a long time long ago when popes were kings.
It has another dimension, though, to it, particularly the way John Paul II instituted it. It has a dimension that, at a certain level, is very modern. It recognizes pop culture for what it is. It recognizes the need for a cult of the personality, in a way, which is a very modern thing. If you go from sort of Hitler to Mao to whoever, and the capacity of multimedia to multiply the value of an event time and time and time over. I mean, you're a participant in that.
I blame myself and I blame the media for creating these monstrosities. Without television, John Paul II wouldn't have been the Pope he was, but he was a master at it. And television were willing co-conspirators with him because they needed a celebrity type as much as the Pope needed their transmission belt. So he became like a Madonna or an Elvis. And television could sell that image instantly. Benedict, they could get audience.
Benedict has shown he prefers Mozart to Madonna.
Yeah, right. Well,
is that a genuine change in sensibility?
He's going along with the program. It's very hard for him to not do what his predecessor did. So everybody expected him to have a World Youth Day. He had one in Munich in 2005, went to his home country of Germany, and he had a big crowd there. I think there's a certain kind of Catholic who will go anywhere to see a man in a white cassock and a funny hat who calls himself a pope. They think maybe he's a god. At least he's a demigod. Not good. That's idolatry. Very close to idolatry.
Robert Blair Kaiser, your view of the church reflects your journey as a human being. Yet you still find in the church a place of refuge for yourself. You still find what the church does for you as an individual to some extent valuable. What are the things that you value so much about the church, both as an institution and a bearer of spirituality, that sustains you?
The institution is a counter-irritant, so it's not the institution that I love. Far from it. I love the intimacy. I like the idea that I can go to communion and speak in my heart to Jesus within me. I like the idea that when I finish going to Mass, that the priest says, go, the Mass is finished. That's a bad translation. The real translation is, go, you are sent. In other words, we are all missioned. The primary change that takes place, we used to call transubstantiation, is not in the bread and the wine that are transformed into the body and blood of Christ. According to the Anglican Roman Catholic dialogues that went on for 10 years, 20 years after Vatican II, the primary change that takes place is in us. We become other Christs, and we go out and make a better city, a better county, a better state, a better nation, a better world. That's the transubstantiation that I enjoy. And I stay with this Roman Catholic Church arm of Christianity because we have 1.2 billion members. Imagine the potential power of this if we really get into feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and finding shelter for the homeless.
So there are benefits in the Church Universal.
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, I'd like to get the message across to others, too. Thanks to people like yourself, I'm doing that.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Our guest has been Robert Blair Kaiser. It's been great to have you with us. Time's running out. We're going to finish, though, with Decora Lux. St. Peter and St. Paul has been the feast in recent weeks.
Uh-huh.
And that's an anthem to the foundation of the church.
Right. We shouldn't forget that foundation. Something happened when the second person of the Blessed Trinity became man. It's a mystery. They call it the incarnation. We're not exactly sure what that means, that Jesus was fully human and fully divine at the same time. There's an ambiguity about it, but we live with it, and we kind of revel in it.
Well, here's a little local indulgence. We're going to play a version sung by the seminarians and ex-students of the late-lamented St. Patrick's College, Manly. Robert Blair Kaiser, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Been a great conversation.
Oh.
Decora Lux. The priests and ex-seminarians of St. Patrick's Manly on the occasion of its demise, its close. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Robert Blair Kaiser had a selection from Sound of Music. Let's have another one before the news. Here's one of the great ones, adopted as an anthem by that other religious tradition, sport, particularly English football teams. Yes, you guessed it. Climb Every Mountain.
Climb every mountain, search high and low, follow every byway, every path you know. Climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow every rainbow, till you find your dream, a dream that will need
Sound of Music. Oh, and it plays on forever, really, doesn't it? You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest in this past hour has been Robert Blair Kaiser. Let's finish with another one of the favourites. Here's Stanley Holloway. Get me to the church.
I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Some blows I go, lift up the table and get me to the church on time. If I am flying, they shoot me down. If I am wooing,